should start recording the podcast.
Yes.
You know, before we start, can I just do a little bit of housekeeping here? I want to say a couple things.
Go ahead.
One, I wanted to give a big thank you to our super fan Beth Oren, who sent me a copy of a wonderful book called Walking with Ramona, Exploring Beverly Cleary's Portland, which is walking tours of Portland where you get to see all the various places that Beverly Cleary lived and all the places that are mentioned in the Henry Huggins and Ramona stories. I myself have never been to Portland, but one of these days I'm going to go and I'm going to take this book with me. And I recommend this book highly to anyone who's interested in Beverly Cleary. It's a lovely little book.
I haven't seen it. I don't live anywhere near you. I haven't had a chance to share in it.
But I do want to say one other thing, which was we left off on the conversation of socks talking about wondering what the original illustrations were like. And
yeah.
I got my hands on an original copy of socks done with the illustrations by Beatrice Darwin, and they are absolutely phenomenal. I posted them to the Sophomore Lit Facebook page, so anyone who's on that group has seen them already. But I cannot stress enough for people to go out and find these original illustrations. They are just crazy good, and they are so redolent of the early 70s, so amazing, and they kind of changed the way I felt about the book. You know, I realized that sometimes pairing a really good illustrator with an author can give you a different feel for what's happening. And I wonder if I had read this book originally with that, I might have been a little bit more positive in my assessment.
And speaking of that, you were very kind to send me a copy of Beverly Cleary's The Real Hole, which people would be able to hear our episode on if they are contributors to the... is this a bonus episode?
It
I don't remember what happened.
It was
with
the
this.
Bonus episode, yes.
Okay. I don't remember what happened with that episode. If you are a... I don't know how to describe this. If you are a... you fill in. Fill in what I'm trying to say.
If you're a supporter.
A supporter, that's the word I'm looking for, of the Incomparable Network. You would have heard our The Real Hole episode, and we talk a lot about the long-lost illustrations to that, and John was kind enough to send me a hardback copy with the original illustrations, and it is a dynamic book. It is so just worth having just to see the original pictures and how they, as you said with socks, just change the entire feel of the story.
Yeah. So... I guess this is an advertisement for ABE Books now.
Yeah, and also for being a supporter of our show on the Incomparable Network. And, you know, if you want to, you know, throw some money towards me and John, maybe we could fly out to Portland together one day and do an episode from there. Maybe sitting at the foot of the Ramona statue in the park. What's the park called? I don't even know what the park
is
called.
The park. I don't know. I don't have the book in front of me right now.
Well,
speaking of Ramona.
Ramona.
Ramona Quimby, brave and fearless, was half running, half skipping to keep up with her big sister Beatrice on their way home from the park. She had never seen her sister's cheeks so flushed with anger as they were this August afternoon. Ramona was sticky from heat and grubby from landing in the sawdust at the foot of the slides, but she was proud of herself. When Mrs. Quimby had sent the girls to the park for an hour, because she had an errand to do, an important errand, she hinted, she told Beezus, as Beatrice was called, to look after Ramona. And what had happened? For the first time in her 6 years, Ramona had looked after Beezus, who was supposed to be the responsible one.
So, speaking of Ramona, this is like, we are now, okay, allow me to posit an opinion, put forward a theory here. This book, what we're covering today, Ramona the Brave, here we are at the, what I consider a turning point now in Beverly Cleary's career, her writing style, her output, and the show itself. Like, I feel like we are now shifting into the second half of Beverly Cleary's career as a novelist, because things change dramatically with today's book, with Ramona the Brave.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I mean, there was the earlier Ramona book, Ramona the Pest, which is an excellent book, make no mistake. Mm-hmm. But this book, everything comes together to create the kind of new family dynamic that becomes the center of Cleary's writing from here on. It drops the episodic nature of the earlier books. This is a story that a plot line is followed throughout the book. It mm-hmm. also drops, we say goodbye pretty much to Henry Huggins at this point, who was still kind of a hanger-on in Ramona the Pest. And in his place, we get the parents, the Quimbys themselves, are given new prominence to this book. And that relationship between sibling and sibling and child and parent is so well covered in this book, so beautifully and intricately and nuanced in its depiction. Yeah, I would say this is a very different book altogether.
We also see, if you go from Ramona the Pest to Ramona the Brave, what year was Ramona the Pest? That was 1960.
68, I think.
Yeah, we see with Ramona the Pest, a book that was clearly looking at the fading styles and attitudes of the early 60s. Ramona the Brave is a book that's very, very set in 1975. It is very set in the mid 70s. That's reflected in the fact that if you look at like the way Miss Binney is portrayed in Ramona the Pest, the teacher, the way the kids are treated, the way Davy is described, the way Ramona's mother seems to have this, like, her job is to get Ramona ready and get her to school and chatter with the neighbors. This book is a very much a reflection of what was happening in families in the mid-70s. Like, we are done with the 60s now. We are, things are a little harder on families. This book is a lot more grounded in psychology. It's a lot more grounded in parenting style, and it's from here on we are in this forward momentum with the Ramona books, where they will start coming one after the other, and having a continuity and a through line that will just carry this character on now up through the early 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's funny. I remember reading, this is one of the Ramona books I do remember reading as a kid. I was probably in fourth grade, I think, when I read this book. I'm thinking about other things that happened. So I was kind of late to reading this book. It had been out for a while before I read this. But I remember being scandalized at the beginning of the book when the instigating conflict at the beginning of the book is Ramona wants to defend her big sister Beezus's honor against a couple of neighborhood bullies who are teasing her by chanting Jesus Beezus. Yep. And I was scandalized by this as a kid, because this did not seem like the Cleary I knew.
Yeah.
That she would come out and actually make, I mean, it's today it seems like a pretty, you know, pretty tame joke, but that she would address religion at all in the book.
Yeah.
That seemed weird to me. It was like, this was not part of the universe. And she
actually addresses religion several times in this book.
Yeah, exactly. This book deals with the reality of being a kid on the cusp of trying to figure out what really is important, what isn't important. You know, you've been given a lot of rules when you're very young, and you more or less accept those rules as just having come from your parents or from society or whatever. And there comes a point where you start to have to sort out what really matters and what's really serious and what's not really serious. And there's a lot of points in this book where Cleary has a great deal of fun with something that the kids take very seriously that the parents can't take seriously.
This book also is, it states a thesis at the beginning that it sees through all the way. It deals with Ramona and her her relationship to the concept of bravery and herself as a brave person. And what does that mean? What does it mean to be brave? What does it mean when you're a child and you're brave? Is it in the things you do? Is it in the way you feel about yourself? Is it in the way people perceive you? And the book covers all those angles. Like, what is bravery in Ramona's world? And that impressed me again on this read through that Cleary never drops that theme. Like, it just continues to pick at it and explore it chapter by chapter.
I wonder, as I'm looking through it, that there are points in here that are so well observed. There's a part where Ramona talks about being able to pull certain words off of signs as she's passing them.
Yeah.
And those are the only words she can read. That's the sort of the way in which reading comes in fits and starts, that you have a core group of words that you know, and then you're trying to guess at everything else around it. I wonder if these books reflect a closeness with childhood, in that these are the books that are being written after Cleary had her own kids, as opposed to the Huggins books were written through the memory of childhood.
Mm, that makes a lot of sense.
But yeah, do we need to give a plot summary or anything here? Or
I think we should I mean, it's a very simple story. I can give a quick rundown of what happens.
Sure.
So in the book, we're you know, this is a book about Ramona being brave. She's in first grade now, and it starts off with Ramona defending Beezus against these sixth grade boys in the park, and we get the sense that Beezus. We don't get to hear a lot from Beezus in this book, but Beezus is going through her own stuff. She's being teased. Ramona is confused that the way she tried to defend her sister wasn't well received by her sister. But we also learn that Mrs. Quimby has a secret. And what that secret ends up being is that Mrs. Quimby has taken a job working for a doctor, like as a receptionist. So the family can afford to expand the house because the sisters are getting too big to share a room. And so they're building a new room onto the house, and that the girls are going to take turns sharing it. And that Ramona is going to be the first of the girls to be able to use the new room. And Ramona is very excited because this is the first time she's gotten to be first at pretty much anything because of her age. Soon the workmen come. They break a hole in the house where Ramona and Howie enjoy playing through this hole. It's very exciting for Ramona to have a hole in the house, but then she realizes that it's kind of scary also to have a hole in the house. And when she starts first grade, it causes a problem because her new teacher, what is her name? Mrs. Griggs, has Ramona tell what happened over the summer. Ramona says they tore a big hole in the house. They smashed a hole in the house. And chopped a great big hole in the house. And Howie, Ramona's friend, says that Ramona is not telling the truth, which she wasn't, because they didn't actually chop it in the house. And this begins the beginning of Ramona's troubles in school. This carries on through Ramona having her paper bag owl copied by Susan, which Ramona responds to by crumping up Susan's paper bag owl. Ramona hiding this information from her parents, who find out about it on parents' night. A strange defense by Beezus for Ramona's actions, and Ramona having to apologize to Susan in front of the class. Eventually, Ramona does get to stay in the room, but it proves to be a very scary experience being all alone for the first time in her life. And you learn that she has sort of a relationship with her father, that she kind of depends on Mr. Quimby to kind of give her some of the bravery she needs in order to feel safe at night. A lot of this comes to a head with Ramona saying a bad word to her family, losing her shoe to an angry dog outside of school, building herself a paper slipper, and proving that she is indeed a brave girl in the eyes of not only herself and her parents, but the administration at the school as a whole. And that is more or less Ramona the Brave.
You know, as you were listing this off, I was thinking about a lot of the incidents of this book, and many of these things have stuck with me over the years, but I also realize I have analogs in my own childhood for almost everything that happened to Ramona in this book, which goes to show how insightful this book is. It really, really gets into the mindset of what it is to be at that age. And you mentioned Beezus's defense of Ramona. That is I think you'd also mentioned before, as we were talking about this ahead of time, that that's central to this book is the emerging relationship between Beezus and Ramona.
Yeah.
They're no longer in utter opposition as the older child and the pest, the bossy one and the one who's seeking to find her own room in the her own room in the world. But now they can be allies too. There's these moments of incredible delicacy between the two of them in this book.
Yeah, and I think that going back episodes and episodes, when I was talking about the arc of Beezus, like tracking Beezus as a character, and part of Beverly Cleary's talent is in doing that in the background of a story. Beezus isn't the main character in this. You mostly just see her in scenes and Ramona thinking about her. But Beezus is clearly at a point in her life now. She's in sixth grade. She's worried about what the other kids think about her. She's worried about what the boys think about her. You sort of see her subtly develop a crush on her teacher, or not so subtly, I guess. She's not portrayed as like just rough adolescence. She's also developing empathy in a very subtle way, in a way that kids start developing empathy at this age. She's able to see past her irritation at Ramona and get to the heart of what Ramona's experiencing. She's able to apply her own memories to what Ramona's feeling. And it's not pointed out. It's just a thing that happens. But if you're paying attention to Beezus in this book, you can see that she's grown a lot from the last book as well, and that it's happening. It's happening in its natural progression, which is something that Cleary is so good at doing, just letting characters grow as they will.
Yeah. Now, we should of course mention this is the first of the Alan T. Green books.
Yes.
And that's another way that these books are brought into the 70s. As much as I adore Lewis Starling, by the end of the 60s, it was a very backwards-looking style. It was a style that really belonged to the 1950s.
Yeah.
I don't begrudge him his long life, and I don't begrudge him being a great illustrator for these books. But T. Green comes in, and it's just like a statement of intent. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Whereas Darling was so elegant and fine-lined and everything was kind of machined, it looked like it was done on a French curve or something. T. Green is just very scruffy and scratchy and inky, and everyone has scraggly 70s hair.
Yep.
And torn 70s jeans, and they're all wearing, ringer t-shirts and stuff.
And her parents, the parents always look tired. He's able to draw Ramona's parents in such a way that you always feel like they just got home from work without overdoing it. He's able to draw, especially when it comes to the later books, when he draws Ramona's father, he's able to just convey the weight of what's happening in these stories on the adults without hitting you over the head with it. He also draws Ramona's nose in this funny little way that as a child, I was always just taken by no one drew little kids' noses the same way Alan T. Green did. And it's just always stuck with me. Like, to me, that's Ramona's face, because these are the memories I carry. Because I read Ramona the Brave probably when I was in second or third grade. And so these are the illustrations I grew up with.
Yeah. Well, they're the only illustrations so far, except for, I guess now Tracy Dockray has.
No.
No.
The edition I have is illustrated by Jacqueline Rogers.
Oh, really?
And the cover is a takeoff on T. Green's original cover with Ramona on the swing. Only Jacqueline Rogers is a good illustrator. There is something about the original illustration of Ramona on the swing in T. Green's version that is, you can just feel the movement. Like, this one lacks that. But also the pictures in the inside are, they're very, very competent. They're a little too round, a little too not even cartoony, just, you know that T. Green knows what he's doing. And these are great, great pictures. I don't know where if they're in a print version. I have, this is the one I got online, But tea greens are just, they are the gold standard as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So, how do you want to do this? You want to talk about individual chapters? Do you want to?
Sure. Let's just sort of like walk through it, hit the points that we like the gorilla in the Wild Animals of Africa book.
Yes. Well, you say what you're going to say about that. Then I have one of my patented dumb anecdotes about this.
Well, I was going to actually say, so the Ramona has this book called Wild Animals of Africa, and she's fascinated by the picture of the gorilla in it. And it's because to her, it's a terrifying, and she likes to scare herself by looking at the picture of the gorilla. And it eventually gets to the point where she doesn't want the book in her room at night because she's afraid of this gorilla. In fact, she and Beezus invent a story, a ghost story, about the gorilla that is legitimately frightening. And I had forgot, I think I forget about it every single time I read this book until I get to it. And then I'm like, oh, that's right. Like, they have this story about a ghost. Like, the gorilla is a ghost and it has no, like, skin, like, no skeleton, like a ghost with, like, they're coming up with a ghost story, and it's like a ghost that oozes in between the holes in the walls. It's a clammy ghost that sobs in the night and has icy fingers. And then there's a gorilla without bones that can ooze around. Like, it's this really, really graphic, like, thing that kids would do to, like, one-up each other. And it reminds me, I used to check these books out from the library in my elementary school that were, like, books about ghosts, like, about hauntings and stuff. And they had these covers that were just terrifying for me. They had like these sort of like watercolor illustrations of various ghosts and haunts and ghouls. And I had one of those books checked out from the school library and was so freaked out by it being in my room that I had to take it downstairs after my parents had gone to bed and hide it underneath the living room couch and then take it out right before I went to school the next day because I was so afraid of that book.
Was this one of the scary stories to tell in the dark books?
It was not one of the scary stories. It was a nonfiction book about ghosts. Oh. like true hauntings.
Oh, there were a lot of those books. Scholastic books sold so many paperbacks that said true stories of the unknown, and they would always be like cryptozoological animals, or they would be UFOs, or they would be vampires or ghosts or whatever. And as a kid, I believed that when they said that there was true stories, I could not believe that they would actually lie to me as a kid and publish that they said was true.
Oh, they would. Actually, the series was called The World of the Unknown, all about ghosts. If you want to go into AVE Books and take a look, I am sure you can find a used copy of The World of the Unknown, all about ghosts. Terrifying. The cover and the illustration is a bunch of spectral monks emerging from the ruins of a long forgotten monastery. So, what is your story?
Well, when I was very little, I was terrified of skeletons. I remember that every time I would see a picture of a skeleton, it terrified me. And my big brother Rob did not like me hanging out with him. He was much more like Beezus in Ramona the Pest. He wanted me gone, and so he tried to keep me out of his room by putting up skeletons. Like he had this one of those old cardboard Halloween skeletons he hung up, and I actually got my parents to make him take that down. I would enter his room and I would have to stare at the ground because I did not want to see the skeleton hanging on his closet door. And one morning he took out the How and Why Wonder Book of the Human Body and opened it to a picture of a skeleton and put it on the floor. So as I was walking in, my eyes glanced on this and I ran all the way back from his room into my bedroom. So Rob, if you're listening to this, I don't forgive you.
And you were what, like 13, 14?
Yes, I was 13.
I know that I do. I have not shared this story. This is really quick. I'm just really quick. I was terrified of E.T. when it came out. Like I was horrified by the E.T. creature, the goblin, the thing. And I was so afraid of E.T. that my mother had cut a story out of the newspaper about the little person actor who played E.T. in the puppet. And there was like two, like maybe 3/4 inch square photos in the article, one of the face of E.T. and one of the face of the actor. And she had magneted it. I don't know why she cut it out. Like, I have no idea why she cut this out. She magneted it to the side of the refrigerator that was facing the back door of the house. I was so scared of E.T. that even though this image of E.T. was about the size of my thumbnail, we would get out of the car, leave the garage, approach the side of the house. I would walk all the way around to the front of the house and wait until someone walked all the way through the house and let me in the front door, because I refused to be on the side of the refrigerator that picture of E.T. was on. I was so scared of E.T. And like, I had friends, this was the height of E.T. I had friends who would wear shirts with his face, and I like couldn't look at them while they were talking to me. Like, I was so scared of the goblin.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Just like Ramona.
Just like
See,
Ramona.
Bring it all back.
Exactly.
So more happens in this book.
The hole in the house. I remember, I mean, I have a feeling this episode is just going to be me coming up with childhood stories that are analogous to this, but the scenes of Howie and Ramona jumping through the house and the way that completely messes with your categories as a child resonate with me, because my parents started a renovation project at our house in Eureka. Much old. I was a bit older than Ramona, but I remember somewhere along the line, things stopped with this project. And I don't know whether, you know, even today, I don't know whether it's because my parents lost interest or they ran out of money or whatever.
Right.
But for a long time, and probably, you know, I was a kid, probably a long time for me was like 4 months or something like that. But it seemed like forever. There was just this hole there in the house that they put a plastic sheet over, and it was disturbing to me. It was disturbing because it really ruins the idea of what a house is for you as a kid.
I think that comes through in this book. It messes with Ramona's head that there is this hole just in the wall with this plastic sheeting over it. I think that this book also does a great job at painting a portrait of what kind of person Howie is going to grow up to be. He used to be just kind of like the boy in the book, and he's shaping up to be a little sullen but very literal-minded. And it's because he's so literal-minded that Ramona gets in trouble, not in trouble, but gets embarrassed in class when he says that, no, men didn't come and chop a hole in your wall. And then later on, he's like, they didn't chop a hole in your wall. They removed it they pulled the boards off with a crowbar. Like, that's that. And it does a good job at not just like showing the difference between Ramona and Howie and how they're still friends in spite of their differences, but also that personality carries through in the books, but not in a rigid way. He won't stay this way, but it's a good starting point for a first grader. And I have a first grader. So reading this book is Alana said this to me just the other day. She was like, Mitzi is Ramona. And I was like, yeah, she really is. Like, and not just in the, I recognize her experiencing these similar things. Mitzi, my daughter, is very much like this child. She's incredibly imaginative. She's very hard to control. She has trouble sitting still in school. She's always getting called out by the teacher for talking, for not paying attention to her work. She has no patience for kids who are a little introverted or a little shy or a little like quiet. She's bossy. She's rambunctious. And just the other night, she was still awake at like 9:30, and Alana was like, "What is going on?" And Mitzi's like, "A friend of mine told me a scary story today at school, and she couldn't stop thinking about it. So she was just lying in bed, like thinking about this scary story a kid had made up." And I'm like, "Yep, you're at that age where like your imagination's just gonna just keep repeating stuff." Yeah, so this book, like you said, like not only just remembering stuff from my childhood, but I am living with this child right now. And so I'm just seeing, like, it's just bouncing back and forth in my psyche.
The literal-mindedness of Howie is what starts the troubles that she has with Mrs. Griggs. And those troubles come to a head with this owl segment where they are given the craft project of making owls out of paper bags. Just before we recorded this, I was having dinner with my wife, and we were reminiscing on the various craft projects we did as a child and thinking about all the supplies you had to buy when you were a kid of construction paper and glue or paste, depending on whether you were a glue school or a paste school, and all the crayon boxes. But I was going to say, I had an owl experience in that it was the third grade. We were given the project to make snowmen. They were going to, you know, how they give you a project, they give you a basic template, you make your snowman, then the teacher hangs them all up on the wall or whatever. And we were all making snowmen, and I had just recently seen a craft book that was of paper folding. And I had the idea that I was going to give my snowman a hat with a little flower on the side of its band, and I was going to bend up the petals, and I carefully bent up all these petals to give it a volumetric effect. And then I made a little feather out of construction paper where I made each little frond separately, and I bent those up, and I kind of carefully twisted it, and I put it up. And all the kids in the class stared at me like I was from outer space. Like I had, like, you know, if you ever read the book Flatland, there's this, uh-huh. there's a sequence where people move out of two dimensions into three dimensions. They just cannot comprehend that. And this was what happened in this class. I was moving out of two dimensions into three dimensions. And everyone in the class copied it. I'm not lying. Everyone in the class copied my snowman. And I was at once, I was very angry the way Ramona was, but I also had this feeling of overwhelming power, which I don't think Ramona had.
No.
Which kept me from having my crumple up the owl moment, I guess. But
well, I too have an owl story. It is not the same as yours. It is not thematically similar to yours. It is more structurally similar to Ramona's, in that we had to make owls just like this in elementary school. And one thing I love about the way this is set up is that Beezus had Mrs. Griggs, and so when Ramona will mention things about Mrs. Griggs' class, Beezus will be like, oh, owls. Yeah, I remember doing owls. and I'm like, yeah, because I have an older sister, and she had been through not the same teachers necessarily, but the same school. And so she's like, oh, now you're doing the owls. So the owl project was just this. You brought a brown paper back to school. Why owls? Was it because it was fall? Maybe it was heading into fall, so owl? I don't know. In any case, it's a thing. And you would make the owl with the beak like on the fold, like on the, like you'd fold it down like a paperback puppet, and the beak would be sort of hanging over the fold. So if you worked it like a puppet, the mouth would kind of open and close. And so we each got to do whatever we wanted to do. We got to decorate our owls however we wanted. All you had to do was to have the eyes, feathers, and the beak, and then you could do whatever else you wanted with it. And I worked very hard on my owl because I like to show off, and I think I gave it glasses or something. I most likely gave it glasses. I gave everything glasses. But then she hung them up, like the teacher hung up all the owls on the wall, and I don't remember which student it was. I want to say it was Nora Mallory, but I won't, but I think it was, but I'm not sure. But in my memory, it was Nora Mallory. Nora, if you're out there listening, it probably wasn't you. One of the students had done their owl, and underneath the beak had drawn a mouth. And A, that doesn't make any sense. But B, the teacher said, oh, look, Nora. I know it probably wasn't Nora, but I'm going to say it in this anecdote. Look, Nora gave her owl a little mouth. How wonderful. And all the class was like, oh, that's so neat. Like, oh, it has a little mouth. And I was just stewing the whole time. I was like, that's not the way owls work. The beak is the mouth. That's an owl's mouth. It's right there. And every time I walked past that board with the owls on it, I just got angrier and angrier at the stupid mouth on that stupid owl. It doesn't matter what it looks like, it's wrong. It's physiologically impossible. That mouth would have been in the owl's neck. Like, it doesn't, that's not even a thing. And to this deck, that's just one of those things that still sits with me. So that's my owl story. I felt rage, the artistic rage, the way Ramona felt. It would be like if someone was in an architecture class and one of the students got like, oh, how wonderful that you designed a house with no roof. And everyone was like, yay. And you're like, no, it's not the way it works. Like, so I didn't crumple up this person's owl, but what happens to Ramona is Susan copies Ramona's owl, like, beat for beat. Ramona does a wonderfully creative owl. She is not just Susan copies it, but she watches Susan copy it, which is the most frustrating part. Like, she can't do anything. Susan is clearly copying her owl. And then, of course, Mrs. Griggs sees Susan's owl first. And so Susan gets all the praise for all the innovations in her design. And Ramona is so infuriated that first Ramona crumples up her own owl and says that she just doesn't like owls. And then when
she
all
says,
the owls
I
are going...
I do not care for owls.
That's right. And then when Susan's owl is being put on display for parents' night, Ramona just snaps and crumples it up and throws it, like twists it up and throws it away. And then beats Cheeks home. Like, she bursts out of, like, she pushes through the students, runs home, falls, scrapes her knee. And this is a moment in this book that I remember as a kid making me cry, where Ramona is, she falls, she skins both of her knees up bloody, bursts into her house and yells, "Mama, mama, I fell down." And her mama sweeps her up into her arms and takes care of her knees. And I remember reading that when I was a little kid and just crying, because Beverly Cleary built the frustration and the anger so well to that point that I had a like a cathartic moment myself reading it. As I think it was like my first real like uncontrollable emotional response I had as a child to like something like that visceral, like being able to relate entirely to the way she felt and like responding as she responded, like while reading it, was it's so well done. And she does it like five times in this book, builds Ramona's like tension to the breaking point and then just has this cathartic moment.
Yeah, this is a much more emotional book than a lot of Cleary's earlier books. We've talked quite frequently about Cleary's her lack of sentimentality as a writer, and the way that she's she doesn't tend to go for big cathartic moments, but with the Ramona books she does have these moments, and they are completely earned by the action of what happens. You know, if you're a writer, you're quite often warned by writing professors and stuff not to have characters break down and cry, because that's a way of trying to elicit a response from your reader, to get sympathy for a character. And you have to be warned, be careful if you haven't actually earned that moment. But Cleary earns every one of the cathartic moments of these books that she writes.
She does. And this chapter ends with one of the most moving passages. Ramona's been crying because of everything that happened, and she looks at herself in the mirror, and she sees her reflection all puffy-eyed staring back at her. And the last paragraph says, "Ramona scowled and the girl scowled back. Ramona managed a small smile. So did the girl. Ramona felt better. She wanted the girl in the mirror to like her."
Yeah.
And that is just like, You're having this little girl who isn't just going through like a really hard time, like emotionally and personally. She's concerned that the way she's behaving and feeling is bad or incorrect. And if you really want to tug my heartstrings, you have that be a recurring theme of a child having internal struggles with their own emotions. One thing I love about this is the book doesn't villainize Mrs. Griggs. She's not a very sympathetic teacher, but she's not a bad teacher. She's just a different kind of teacher than Ramona's used to. And she's sort of overwhelmed. You can tell she's kind of overwhelmed by her job. And she's just not as perceptive as, say, Mrs. Benny was.
I think a lot of this book is about Ramona discovering that that things aren't always going to be perfect and things aren't always going to be just in her world. And you just have to kind of roll with that. Miss Benny was such an important figure in Ramona's life, and so much of that first book was about, does Miss Benny love me? Does she care for me? And the affirmation that she mattered to her teacher was very, very important to Ramona. In this book, Mrs. Griggs is, you know, she's not a terrible teacher, but she's just not an inspiring teacher either. And Ramona is dealing with the fact that not only does she not, she's not sure that Mrs. Griggs is ever going to like her. She's not actually sure that she wants Mrs. Griggs to like her, because
yeah,
and that's a hard thing too. You know, that the issue with the owl becomes a difficult thing because Ramona just has to eat that entirely. She has to eat her ego. By the end of the story, she has to give an apology to Susan. She mitigates that by saying under her breath that you, even though you did copy my owl, but you know, it's not a win for Ramona. The win comes in the fact that Ramona grows a little older and realizes that sometimes the right thing to do is not the thing that brings justice to the world, but the thing that brings peace to the world.
Yeah, and she, but again, like, it's never spelled out that in that pat a manner.
Right.
She's just experiencing these things and learning a little bit as she does them, but there's not any like major epiphanies so much as just these little pieces of the puzzle that are adding to her, that are adding to her personality. That night after she scrunches up the owl, the night her parents have the parent teacher night, Ramona is left at home and in bed. She gets up and writes a note because she needs to talk to her mother about what happened. And she writes the first note she's ever left for her mother. She writes, "Come here, mother, come here to me," which is a heartbreaking little note. And she said, "No need to sign the note. Her mother would know who it was from because Beezus wrote cursive." And it works. Her mother comes in and is like, I had no idea you were old enough to leave a note. And they talk about what Ramona did in the class. And this is the point where you get this moment with Beezus where, you know, their parents are like, it doesn't, you know, it's not a big deal. It's not, you know, it's not a big deal that what happened. And Beezus actually stands up for Ramona and she says, "No, it is actually a big deal what happened." Like, I get it. Like, I get that there's something about this that isn't right in a child's world. And that Ramona knows she's going to have to apologize to the class. And this is where Beezus says, "Yeah, Mrs. Griggs is big on apologies." But also, it's that thing where it's like, you've got to apologize not because we know you're really sorry, but because that's simply the way things are done.
I find it kind of a hard chapter even now as a grown up, because yeah, I just know the older you get, the more you realize that there are things that are going to go wrong in your life that just aren't going to ever be made right. And you're just going to have to sit with that.
Yep. It's one of those things where, like, as an adult with kids, you have to learn how to like mediate things like this that your children do. Your children will do stupid, impulsive, loud, sometimes violent things that then they're going to have to like apologize for or pay for or retract or take or walk back. And you have to teach your child how to navigate those rough situations, because later in life, you're going to have to make apologies you don't mean and smooth over problems you created that you didn't intend to. And it's interesting to like just watch Ramona like take those first few steps into this ridiculously weird, convoluted adult world.
Right. What's interesting to me is the next chapter after that is her sitting with her feelings for a while and sitting with that the feelings of ambivalence she has about Mrs. Griggs and her continuing fear about the gorilla picture. And she's it's kind of a long, dark night of the soul chapter. But what brings her out of this is at the end of the chapter, she's sitting in a stairwell at her school and she meets the teacher that Beezus has, Mr. Cardoza, the one that she has the crush on. Because for Beezus, Mr. Cardoza is her Miss Benny. She's the teacher that she will look back on for the rest of her life as being a formative adult in her life.
Yeah.
And you get to see here in just two pages here, you get to see why Mr. Cardoza is such a great person. Because he sees her and he says, oh, it's the famous Ramona Q. And being seen and being noticed and being and knowing that this legendary adult from Beezus' life knows who she is, kind of elevates Ramona out of this funk.
Yeah, she says she had expected him to tell her, if he knew who she was at all, that she was Beatrice's little sister. And what do you think of Mr. Cardoza? Like, what do you think of him as a teacher, just from what you know of him?
He just seems to me like he strikes me as a kind of a guy who knows he knows that he's got a lot of charisma with the kids.
Yeah, there's a part of me that when I read Mr. Cardoza, not when I was a kid, but now when I read this book, I'm like, Mr. Cardoza is getting a little too familiar with those kids. Yeah. Like, I'm like, he needs to dial it back. But it reminds me that this book was set in the mid 70s.
Yeah, I mean, that is the thing. This is always an interesting question. You know, today I think we have these expectations of strong boundaries, and for mm-hmm. good reasons, because during the 1980s there was a lot of concern over the discovery of the widespread issue of abuse of children and of inappropriateness of children. But I think, you know, in the 70s there was a real sense of informality and intimacy coming to every kind of relationship you had, the idea that even the professional people in your life, even the teachers in your life would be that way. I remember I was recently at a dinner with a bunch of other academics, and there were some older academics who were talking about their days back in grad school. And one of the women who's now a professor said something like, oh yes, and we were all sleeping. We were grad students. We were all sleeping with our professors. And she spoke of that with a certain amount of pride, as though, well, you know, you kids today don't know what that's like, and it's more's the pity. And I was thinking to myself, that is horrific.
Right. Well, I'm not suggesting anything like that from Mr. Cardoza. I was thinking more of a welcome back Cotter type approach. Right. But it is that thing. It's that intimacy with the student body. It's that intimacy that paints the era in which this book is set. Like, in another world, this book series would have been the kids in Mr. Cardoza's class. And it would have been about Mr. Cardoza, the awesome teacher, and like Beezus and her friends, and like what they got up to in Mr. Cardoza's class. As it stands, we only get a small hint of who this guy is.
Right.
Who he is, of course, not Mrs. Griggs. But in a strange way, Ramona finally meeting Mr. Cardoza and the interaction she has with him at the very end of the book helps to put Mrs. Griggs in a better light to Ramona, it seems.
Yeah.
It kind of settles that relationship for her, as strange as that is.
Yeah, sure.
So we get the next chapter is called Ramona Says a Bad Word. And it's another moment in this book where everything builds perfectly to another Ramona outburst. Ramona gets her report card, or her progress report, and she hides it so her parents won't see it. But of course, Beezus brings her home too, and they make Ramona bring it out. And the progress report is fine. It's just like Ramona needs to work on raising her hand and not speaking out without her out of turn and keeping her eyes on her own page. But it means so much more to Ramona because she knows that she's not being understood. She doesn't look at Davy's paper because she's trying to copy or because she's being nosy. She's trying to help Davy. She's has her reasons for being the way she is, and no one understands her. And at the beginning of the book, Beezus yells at her, grow up. And Ramona says, can't you see I'm trying? And that kind of pervades all of this. Like, Ramona's trying to do her best. And she ends up losing her temper with her parents. And she gets so mad, she says, I'm going to say a bad word. And she says it this, I'm going to say that was literally what she says. She stamps her foot when she says it. And the whole family is like, what? And And her parents are like, all right, go ahead and say a bad word if you want to say a bad word. And so she yells out, guts, 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 guts. And then in the narration, it says, there, that should show them. Because she wants to do, she feels, okay, and it's a funny moment, but she feels so bad about herself. Like, not because of what she's done and because she's so misunderstood, she's feeling so terrible just about who she is. That she wants to show her parents that she is a terrible person. Like, she wants to shock them. She wants to hit rock. She wants to bottom out. She wants to just hit rock bottom and just be the worst person in the world if that's how bad she is. Of course, they laugh at her. And that just sends her off into another spiral. And this is where Ramona finally comes out with the fact that she thinks her parents just like Beezus more than they like her. Yeah. Because they're always making fun of her.
Yeah. After they laugh at her, and she says, they say, what are we going to do with you? And she says, with red eyes, a swollen face, and a streaming nose, Ramona sat up and glared at her mother. Love me. Her voice was fierce with hurt. It's such an amazing line, because it's both love me, but it's also love me fueled by anger and hurt. And Beezus is able to diffuse the situation by talking about all the times the parents laughed at her. Mm-hmm. And it's such an interesting description of the dynamics of these kinds of relationships, especially parent-child relationships, which are built upon such inequality of power, that Beezus is doing this as a gesture to bring Ramona up, but she's also finally able to air her own grievances here.
Yeah.
Because she's obviously been holding on to her anger over these things.
And you don't just get Beezus airing her grievances either. You get this shift in perspective for the parents. Like, they honestly listen, and you can tell they're a bit cowed by the fact that they didn't realize all this time that they were hurting their kids in very small ways by doing this. Like, her parents have always been and will remain for a good chunk of these books a little flippant with the kids, especially the father gets they don't always put the kids' feelings first, which is just kind of the people they are, I guess. And this is the first book, the first time the parents really get hit with this feeling of like, oh, we're not only are our kids like, not only are the kids growing and learning, but the parents are also growing and learning throughout these books as well, like how to be parents.
Now, one other thing that happens in this chapter is Picky Picky appears. Now, is this the first time we've seen Picky Picky, or was he in...
He gets mentioned a couple of times earlier on, but this is the first time he does anything.
Yeah, yeah. And Picky Picky, of course, will become central to later books.
Well, was Picky Picky not in Ramona the Pest?
I don't think I remember him in Ramona the Pest, but he could have been.
I think you may be right, but... We are slowly going to see. Oh, he was earlier in this chapter, because Ramona grabbed Picky Picky and carried him to her room to sleep with her.
Right.
But he wouldn't do it. Yeah. This is Picky Picky is slowly becoming an actual character in the family's life.
Yeah.
But he's as cats were when I was a kid, the family cat. And as we talked about in Socks, he was the family cat, which simply meant he was just around. Like, he was not the center of anything. No one was taking pictures of the cat. He was just around.
Yeah. Now, this is a cat that's very much a cat. And whereas Ribsy was much more engaged with Henry Huggins and much more a motivator in the actions that took place in those books, Picky Picky is there to observe and to be disdainful of Ramona, pretty much.
Yeah, and Ramona says, like, why doesn't Picky Picky like me? And her mom says, because he's a very old cat, and because you were very rough with him when you were little. And I go, oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Like, and cats don't forget. Like, that's... we also find out that Beezus had Mrs. Griggs, but didn't care. Like, doesn't have much of feelings about Mrs. Griggs. And that's meaningful, too.
Right.
Like, because she's like, oh, I thought you liked Mrs. Griggs. And she's like... Well, there wasn't anything wrong with her, but she wasn't very exciting. She wasn't mean or anything. We just seemed to go along doing our work, and that was it. And, like, she wasn't unfair. She just liked kids like Beezus. And I think that's very telling. She's like, no, she never did anything to me because I'm the kind of child she liked. Neat and dependable.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm like, all right, yeah, that makes sense. But there was this chapter also ends with another revelation, which is Ramona gets so worn out by everything that's been happening that she's no longer afraid of the dark, because she's too tired to be afraid of the dark anymore. She can't fear shadows and spooks and strange little noises because she's just kind of done with it. And that's kind of how the chapter ends. Like, she's like, I've got more things to worry about in my life.
Yeah, it's an interesting model of maturity, which is you just get worn out on the problems of childhood, and then you can move on to the problems of adulthood.
Yeah, she walks back to her bed, nothing grabs her ankles. She's like, fine. She says her prayers and falls asleep. Yeah. And then we get to the final chapter, in which a lot happens. This is the one part of the book that kind of teeters on a little, like, whoa, like this is an adventure. But Clary manages to bring it home, which is that she's so upbeat, like so much stuff has been taken care of in her life that she feels she's feeling older, she's feeling braver. Her dad was singing Polly Wally Doodle, My Gal She Is a Spunky Gal, about Ramona, and so Ramona considers herself spunky, and she decides to take a different route to school. She goes down a strange street and is confronted by a strange dog, not just a dog, a German Shepherd dog, which at this point, I don't know if people remember this, but at this point in American history, the German Shepherd dog was your go-to pop culture mean dog.
Yeah. Somewhere along the line, Dobermans took over, but...
Yep, Dobermans took over in the 80s, and then it moved on to pit bulls. This was covered in the Rin Tin Tin book by Susan Orlean. She talked all about the perception of the German Shepherd. And so at this point, the German Shepherd was kind of, as if you were an author, you were going to make that your intimidating dog. And it is. It's like, it's apparently a very mean dog.
Yeah, you know, when I was when I lived in Youngstown, Ohio, I would walk from my house to the grade school, which was the Harding Elementary School, which is named after Warren G. Harding, one of our least favorite presidents. And I remember the route I would take. It was several blocks, and there were different ways you basically had to go like three blocks to the north and then three blocks to the west. You could go one block to the north, three blocks to the west. You know, you could traverse it many different ways. But there was one of these routes that would take you down a street that had a dog on it. And that dog terrified me. So reading this book brought back all those memories for me. I mean, I read this book probably about 3 or 4 years later. And it just brought back those memories. Because the dogs, I mean, we've said this before. Even when we were kids, dogs were let roam free a lot more than they are now.
Yeah.
Although, I have to say, I was just down in Florida, and in the neighborhood where my in-laws live, at least, people let their dogs roam pretty free, and they're pretty mean, so maybe it's just a regional thing.
Yeah, I was saying maybe we're just a little privileged now. because we had neighborhood, I think we discussed this episodes ago, but yeah, we had our neighborhood dogs that kind of roamed around, but yeah, we also had mangy dogs that roamed around, like literally mangy dogs, dogs that most likely some of them may have had distemper, like problems going on, and you didn't want to get too close to them because they were somewhat aggressive and no one did anything about them. They were just there. But Ramona has to fend off this dog. First, she throws her lunchbox at it, which doesn't help. So then she throws her shoe at it, her Oxford shoe. And the dog picks it up and trots off with it. And Ramona has to go to school with only one shoe on. And what's funny is Ramona's predicament is so concrete. It's not Ramona like being like wild or crazy. She just walks in with a shoe missing. And the kids, it immediately gets all the kids, including Susan, whom she and Ramona have had nothing but an antagonistic relationship. It even gets Susan on her side. Like, Susan is sympathetic towards Ramona's plight. And she tells the truth about what happened.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is good because, you know, if she had her story about the hole in the house that nobody believed, to have gone through something terrifying like this, you know, kids do like to commiserate on these sorts of things.
Yeah. Yeah, it says, like, I think it says something like, you know, like, the hole in the house was one thing, but all the kids knew about mean dogs. Like, they can all agree. And this is, of course, the sad thing, of course, is that Ramona gets selected. She's been waiting all year to be selected to lead the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah.
And she finally gets called up to the front of the class, and that's where Miss Griggs finds out that she's missing a shoe. It's kind of a little convoluted, like, how this all works out.
Right. Well, Mr. Cardoza makes a reappearance when Ramona has this idea to make herself her own shoe, but she doesn't trust Mrs. Griggs with her plan. She sneaks off down the hall to Mr. Cardoza's room and overhears him explaining how to spell secretary.
Which I still use, by the way.
Oh, yes?
This is what goes through my head when I have to spell secretary.
Oh, well, then we'll repeat it for everyone. Mr. Cardoza says, spelling secretary is easy. Just remember the first part of the word is secret, and think of a secretary as someone who keeps secrets.
It works. It works. Yeah, so she makes this paper slipper out of paper towels. I love the fact this is, again, 1970s. She sneaks off to Mr. Cardoza's during recess.
Yeah.
And then when she returns from Mr. Cardoza's, having borrowed the stapler, Mrs. Griggs says, "Oh, Ramona, we missed you during recess." I'm like, that would not happen at school. Like, they'd be like, "Where's Ramona? Where's Ramona?"
Yeah, I don't know what schools are. You know, my schools, I remember kids wandering around the place all the time and wandering off and doing their own thing. And after school, kids would kind of hang out. You know, I grew up in very rural areas, and there wasn't, I think, a lot of panic over the danger of kids being left unsupervised.
Right.
But, you know, my own kids have gone on to go to school here in Boston, and boy, you better believe there's tight security around schools, high schools,
oh,
and high school in Boston.
Well, yeah, and reading this chapter when Ramona invents the slipper and having my child, again, this is exactly the kind of thing that my daughter would do, is not want to wear one of the leftover boots in the Lost and Found. So you build your own shoe, not because you feel like being particularly creative, but because it's better than doing the thing you don't want to do. And she actually takes a lot of pride in this little slipper she invents. And the teachers seem kind of impressed by it, too. At the end of the day, however, her shoe does get returned to her. The owner of the dog finds it, does some, like, Sherlock Holmesian detective work to figure out that it must be the size of a first grader. And so they call the first grade. And Ramona gets her shoe back. And you have this final scene with Mrs. Miller, the school, like, receptionist. That's very kind of it's a very touching little scene about how brave Ramona must be. The teacher notices that there's like tooth marks on the shoe, and she's like, "Oh, that must have been a, you know, pretty scary dog with pretty big teeth." And Ramona's like, "You know, he was, and he chased me. I took off my shoe and threw it at him, and that stopped him." "Fancy that," Mrs. Miller was plainly impressed by Ramona's story. "You took off your shoe and threw it right at him. You must be a very brave girl." "I guess maybe I am," said Ramona, pleased by the compliment. Of course she was brave. She had scars on her shoe to prove it. And it goes on a little bit after that, but says she hippity-hopped, paper slipper in hand, down the hall to show off her scars to room one. Brave Ramona, that was what they would think, just about the bravest girl in the first grade, and they would be right. This time Ramona was sure. And what touches me about this scene is there is... I work at an organization that works with people with brain injury, and we work with a lot of people with disabilities, and there is a lot to be said for having scars. That language, the language of of your scars are what show what you've been through. Like, they show that you've braved some pretty hard things. And Cleary manages to use that language, not in relation to scars Ramona actually physically has on her body. There's scars on her shoe, but she uses the word scars twice and deliberately. And she says to show off her scars to Room One. And I am touched by that image, the image that this book did, this story did leave scars on this little girl. They're not bad, but it was hard. Like, she went through a lot of hard things and came through a little beaten up, but knowing, not braver, but knowing that she is brave. And that's a big ending for such a little book.
It feels momentous. There are books that you read in childhood that you feel at the end of them, you feel like you've come through something. And I think that those are the books that stuck with me the most. I mean, I think about books like The Phantom Tollbooth. It was a book that really made me feel at the end that the character had actually been through something. Or probably my favorite book in the entire world, The Midnight Fox by Betsy Byers, is another book that has a feeling of this was a pivotal moment in someone's life. And it's remarkable because when we went over the plot, as you went over it, there's not too much happens in this book that seems of importance to an adult, but to the experience of a child, it's utterly important.
Yeah, and Cleary does that thing she does where she lets you in on how important this stuff was without making it seem bigger than it is. She doesn't oversell it. It's just she manages by being true to her characters to remind you, well, to for a child reading it, of course, to say, yes, what you're going through is important enough to write about. And for an adult reading it, saying what you went through and what kids go through is important, and it's important to commemorate, and it's valid. These feelings are all valid.
Who?
And this is just the beginning. This is the beginning of what is essentially the Ramona quadrilogy.
Right.
The next three books are just, she writes, she doesn't pump them out either. This was 1975. The next book is 77, then 79, then 81. So she takes her time with these.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she takes her time with these. And if this podcast, if our production schedule is of any indication, we too will take our time with these books.
So, yes, we've got Ramona and her father coming up next, then Ramona and her mother, and then Ramona Quimby, age 8. And it's going to be quite a series, because these books, they don't droop.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're just getting through these to get to the last Ralph S. Mouse book, though. I mean, when you...
I thought we were headed for Muggy Maggie.
Right. Oh, someone's finally going to read Muggy Maggie. but we kid Muggy Maggie.
Well, we also have Dear Mr. Henshaw.
We have Dear Mr. Henshaw, and dude, I can't wait to talk Dear Mr. Henshaw.
Okay.
That book slapped me across the face when I was a kid. So that was Ramona the Brave, 1975. And it reminds me that a lot of these books were, the plot points from these books were mined for the later Ramona TV series.
Yes.
And it's easy to remember like little incidents from these books, but they do fit together very, like, these books, like you said at the beginning, they aren't incidental. Like, everything that happens because it's part of Ramona's growth and her storyline. Like, these aren't a series of anecdotes. They're very cleverly plotted out.
Yep.
The end.
The end.
The excerpt was read by Nathan Alderman. Click-A-Cast is brought to you
by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com.